To my left, I have Robert Levy, who is a senior fellow in constitutional studies at the Cato Institute. He is an adjunct professor at Georgetown University Law School, a director of the Institute for Justice, and a member of the Board of Visitors of the Federalist Society. Then I have Dave Koppel, who is, you can read his bio, my cohort in the Journal of Firearms and Public Policy, and author of numerous books. And Chuck Michel, who is an attorney from California, also an attorney for California Rifle and Pistol Association, active in the gun rights movement, and one of the best known attorneys in California on the issue. Then on the other side is Alan Corwin, where I'm going to sit because he's not an attorney either. And he will be discussing the Supreme Court cases from the book that he and Dave wrote. And so Mr. Levy is going to go first. Thank you. I'm sorry. There were five people who were listed on the panel, and I'm sorry. Gary Gorski was invited. He said he would come on Monday. He told us he couldn't make it because he was moving this weekend. We had already printed the agenda, and that's why he's not here. Thank you.
Well, it's very nice to be with you. I'm going to talk to you about a case that I hope will wind its way up to the Supreme Court. And if you're really looking for a great Second Amendment case, the best one, in my view, is brewing in Washington, D.C., which enjoys the dubious distinction of being the nation's capital and also the murder capital. There are six District of Columbia residents who want to be able to defend themselves in their own homes. So to vindicate their rights, this past February, three local attorneys and I filed a civil suit in a Washington, D.C. federal court. The case is called Parker versus District of Columbia. Now, it's not about machine guns. It's not about assault weapons. Basically, the case is about the right to own an ordinary garden variety handgun. And we're not talking about the right of the plaintiffs to carry a gun outside the home. That's another question for another day. This case is about a pistol in the home for self-defense. The D.C. government has done almost nothing to disarm violent criminals, but it's done a really good job of disarming decent and peaceable residents. Now, there are lots of cities and states that have restricted gun laws along with high rates of violent crime. So what is there then that's unique about Washington, D.C., and why do the D.C.'s laws have folks like us up in arms? Well, for starters, no handgun can be registered in D.C. None. Period. Even pistols that were grandfathered prior to the District of Columbia's 1976 ban can't be carried room to room in your home unless you have a license, which the District of Columbia never grants. Moreover, all firearms in the home, and this includes rifles and shotguns, they have to be unloaded and either disassembled or bound by a trigger lock. So in effect, no one in the district can possess a functional firearm in his or her own residence. And the law doesn't just apply to unfit people like felons and minors and the mentally incompetent. It applies across the board to ordinary, honest, and responsible citizens. Now, there have been roughly three dozen challenges to the district laws already filed, but mostly they're filed by criminals who have been serving longer sentences because their crimes included gun possession. The case that we filed is quite different. The lead plaintiff, a young lady named Shelley Parker, she resides in a high-crime neighborhood in Washington, D.C. People living on her block are harassed relentlessly by the drug dealers and the addicts, and Ms. Parker decided she was going to do something about it. So she called the police, and she called them again and again and again. And then she encouraged her neighbors to do the same. She organized block meetings to discuss the problem. And for her good citizenship, Shelley Parker has been labeled as a troublemaker by the drug dealers. And they have threatened her every chance that they got. In June of last year, the back window of her car was broken. The following month, a large rock was thrown through the front window of her home. Her security camera was stolen from outside of her house. A drug user drove his car through her back fence, and then finally in February of this year, a dealer known as Nanook started banging on her door and tried to pry his way into her house, repeatedly yelling, "Bitch, I will kill you. I live on this block too." Now, Nanook was eventually arrested. He may or may not be prosecuted in Washington, D.C., but Ms. Parker knows full well that the police are not likely to do very much about the drug problem on her block. And she would like to possess a functional handgun in her own home for self-defense, but of course she fears that if she does so, she will be arrested, prosecuted, incarcerated, and fined because of D.C.'s preposterous gun ban. There's a second plaintiff. He's a special police officer. He carries a handgun all day long to provide security for the Thurgood Marshall Judicial Center, which is a federal office building. But when he applied for permission to possess the handgun, not at the Thurgood Marshall Center, but within his own home to defend his own family, the D.C. government turned him down. Another plaintiff includes a gay man who was assaulted in another city on account of his sexual orientation. He was walking to dinner with a coworker and encountered a group of young men who started yelling, "Faggot, homo, queer, we're going to kill you and they'll never find your bodies." Now, our plaintiff pulled his handgun out of his backpack, and as you can imagine, his assailants backed off. He couldn't have done that in Washington, D.C. Now, there are other aspects of the D.C. lawsuit that makes that suit particularly attractive. Until 1868, when the 14th Amendment was ratified, the Bill of Rights only applied to the federal government. After 1868, some but not all parts of the Bill of Rights can be invoked against the states. Now, unlike most of the 10 amendments, the applicability of the Second Amendment to the states just has not yet been resolved. And yet, because Washington, D.C. is not a state and is controlled by Congress, that complex and widely debated question need not be addressed when D.C. law is challenged on Second Amendment grounds. And finally, felonies under D.C. law are prosecuted by the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, and he's an employee of the Justice Department. And that, of course, is the same Justice Department that's now on record as favoring an individual rights view of the Second Amendment. So for the best chance of success in a case that might wind its way up to the Supreme Court, Second Amendment challenge should be brought in D.C.'s federal court, and that federal court has not yet resolved its view of the Second Amendment. And preferably, the challenge should be civil, not criminal. It should be filed by sympathetic plaintiffs, not bank robbers, not crackheads, but upstanding citizens who want simply to have a gun in their own home. And faced with that type of lawsuit, which is our lawsuit in every respect, a consistent and principled Justice Department would have to side with the plaintiffs. And we hope that the case will wind up before the Supreme Court. So here's where we stand. Our lawsuit was filed in February. The District of Columbia government predictably filed a motion to dismiss the lawsuit, which we, of course, opposed. At the same time, we filed our own motion for a summary judgment in our favor on the lawsuit. The D.C. government didn't respond to that motion by the deadline, which was at the end of March. And when we asked the Corporation Counsel, which is the name of the D.C.'s law firm, that's the official title of the District of Columbia's law firm, when we asked the Corporation Counsel why they didn't respond, effectively defaulting, we were told that the attorney who was assigned to the case is no longer employed by the district and nobody had checked his docket. So this is the usual, you know, the dog ate my homework story. Well, we would have expected that that would redound to our benefit, but it wasn't to be. The judge bent over backwards and gave the Corporation Counsel, the D.C. government, not until a couple of weeks more, but 3 more months until June to file its opposing briefs. 82 days after we had filed our motion to end the case, that's more than 7 times longer than the usual time allowance for these kinds of motions. Well, the D.C. government finally did file its brief, long overdue. We replied a week later, and the case stood that way for 2 months, awaiting the judge's decision. Then at the end of July, which was 7 weeks after all the briefs had been filed, the Brady Center asked the court at that time, 7 weeks after all the paperwork had been filed, for leave to file a friend of the court brief, and the Violence Policy Center did the same thing. Inexplicably, in a case where all the paperwork was complete, the judge, on August the 14th, accepted both of those briefs. And then to show us how fair-minded he was, Clinton appointee, judge gave us 24 hours to identify two outside parties who would like to file briefs on our behalf. 24 hours. And those briefs would be due 2 weeks thereafter. Fortunately, the American Civil Rights Union and the Heartland Institute stepped up to the plate and filed excellent briefs at the end of August. Finally, on September 11th, we filed our own brief responding to Brady and responding to the Violence Policy Center. So mercifully, the paperwork is now finished. Oral argument before the district court is scheduled for October 14th, roughly 2 weeks from now, 3 weeks. For those of us who are eagerly awaiting a Supreme Court pronouncement on the Second Amendment for the first time in 65 years, a challenge to D.C.'s gun ban should be welcome news. The six plaintiffs in Parker versus District of Columbia, they're asking a federal judge to prevent the D.C. government from barring the registration of handguns, from banning the possession of functional firearms within the home, from forbidding firearms from being carried from room to room in your own home without a license, which the government will never grant to you. The plaintiffs live in D.C. They pay their taxes in D.C. They obey all the laws in D.C., but the D.C. government says if somebody breaks into their homes, their only choice is to call 911 and pray that the police arrive in time. That simply is not good enough. The right to keep and bear arms includes the right to defend your property, your family, and your life, and no government should be able to take that away. Thanks very much.
Mr. Levy, you are so on time. Thank you so much. Alan, your turn.
I'll try and make up. Thanks very much. I'm Alan Corwin. I'm the author, with Dave Copel and Steve Halbrook, of Supreme Court Gun Cases, which has just come out. I will be talking about that. I have a few preparatory remarks. Some of you who know me know I have a couple of basic principles that I hold dear. And before I even get to that, I want to thank you and Alan for picking out this beautiful hotel that we're meeting in. The towels in my room are so fluffy, I'm not going to be able to get my luggage closed. I noticed we have very few members of the media here. And I know I send out press releases. I have 1,200 people on my email press release list, about 500 on my fax list. I sent it out twice. Nobody showed. And I figured out what the problem is. We need to have some protests. You can put 400 people in this room who all believe in the same thing. If there were five people outside protesting, then we'd have some news coverage. So we need to make signs. I want a sign that says, NRA is too moderate. We can have a sign that says, arm the pilots, but I think it'd be better to have one that says, arm the teachers. What's that? There you go. He shoots with armed teachers. I shoot with a judge. And maybe we should have one that calls for new classes in schools like field stripping, assault weapons, grades K through 12. Then we'll have the news media here. And one of my big issues as a full-time writer, I've been writing for 20 years, is that the news media doesn't cover this, and they have to. And the book industry also is, by and large, very left of center. I want to tell you a story about what happened to me at Book Expo America, which is the big book convention every year. It attracts 30,000 people. It was in L.A. this year. And I went there with my great big orange button that says, Guns Save Lives. I traveled through the airports with this sign. A lot of people freak out. A lot of people say thanks for that. It's like what Senator Patterson says. You've got to inoculate these people against the bad messages they get. Well, I stopped at one table where they had handmade books. And I'm a writer, so handmade blank books, very appealing to me. Put down my bag, big orange sign, Gun Saves Lives. And the woman looked like she was going to faint. And she's like doing this with her eyes at the button. And I said, my button's making you nervous, isn't it? She said, yeah, it really is. I said, you hate guns, don't you? And she said, yeah, I hate guns. So in my most compassionate voice, I put my arm on her and I told her, it's not good to hate. It had quite an impact. I think I helped her. And I want to help you with something that's very important. we've started to lose sight of what's really going on. And that was something I discovered in the Supreme Court book. We've become what I call hamburgerized. We're used to seeing billboards with a hamburger this thick on TV, in the fast food shops. It's this thick with a thick slab of meat and dripping with cheese and hunks of tomato and onion. And when they deliver the sandwich, the top bun touches the bottom bun. And we go, yum, instead of, huh. You should stand there and go, I want that hamburger. And they're going to tell you that is that hamburger. And you got to start realizing that it's not, because this is leaked into everything we do. We start thinking that getting a permit from the government is freedom. A permit available from the government in right to carry is not freedom to carry with the Second Amendment recognized. We have to start looking for Second Amendment honored freedom to carry, not another state on a list. In Arizona, we've been at this for 6 years. We have 45 states we're restricted from carrying in. It's a scam. It's a big burger on a poster, and it's the two buns touching over here. We're supposed to get rights from this. It's a way to deny our rights, and we miss it. And I'm telling you to watch out for this, because it happens at every turn. And in a minute, I'll show you how it happened with the Supreme Court cases. I personally consider myself a utopian pacifist. I take a position that I think is unassailable. I'm in favor of no weapons of any kind on the face of the earth in an era of enduring peace, lasting prosperity, and abundance. That's what I want. It's a reasonable position. The leftists don't argue with that. They think it's good. But we're far from there. So until we get there, my attitude is disarm everybody, bad guys first. That makes sense. Well, how do you tell who the bad guys are? And then the debate all of a sudden starts to get very reasonable. Well, people have told you for a long time that you don't have rights. You don't have any gun rights. It's a state right. You're being hamburgerized by this. If you didn't have gun rights, then how come there are gun stores? Why don't you have to enlist to go into one? How come there have always been gun stores? How come the National Guard wasn't even an idea until 1903? You've been hamburgerized. Don't let it happen. When David and I started this book, we thought there were half a dozen cases, maybe a dozen cases. He had written up some of the main cases in Dylan's Blue Press. And I met him at one of these conventions. I said, David, let me run those editorials you've already written. We'll reproduce the cases. We'll have a book. It'll be really easy. 6 cases, 10 cases. How many could there be? There are 92 cases that the Supreme Court has decided about guns. And here's the bottom line in this book. The Supreme Court has recognized the individual right to bear arms in defense of yourself and for every other legitimate purpose for 2 centuries. You have rights. That's the bottom line. We threw something else in there that I thought made the greatest point of all, because we have all the self-defense cases, and we have all, by the early 1900s, this was an established matter of law. But in Connecticut, they said, every citizen has a right to bear arms in defense of himself and the state. That was in 1817. And Delaware said, a person has the right to keep and bear arms for the defense of self, family, home, state, and for hunting and recreational use. That was in 1987, 200 years later. And Wyoming said, the right of citizens to bear arms in defense of themselves and of the state shall not be denied. That was in 1889. These statements have been made since our founding. They're all in here, and the Supreme Court was aware of them. The Supreme Court knew what the states were saying in their constitutions, and their decisions bear this out. Now, this is like a talisman. This is the truth. The argument that you don't have rights now dies under the weight of the evidence, and it's here. I'm waiting to see how the left attacks this book, because they haven't come up with anything yet. There's a presentation coming up on October 3rd at the American Enterprise Institute. I want to see what they say, because they got to manufacture new lies, as Alan Gottlieb put it. We've driven a stake through the heart of the anti-rights lobby, and it's going to stay there. Okay. The nice thing is that Supreme Court gun cases reads like a novel. You've got all these self-defense cases. I'll give you one example. Guy finds a man climbing through his wife's bedroom window at night. He goes over to investigate. The guy turns on him with a knife. He shoots and kills him. And then runs away, he's scared. Eventually gets caught and convicted of murder. Because he shouldn't have gone over to look. He instigated the fight. He should have ran away. He should have ducked. He shouldn't have run. Supreme Court overturns unanimously. They say, in their words, it's perfectly normal to go investigate a man climbing in your wife's bedroom window at night. When, I mean, a smart bunch of guys. When he turned on you with a knife, you had a right to stand your ground. He came at you in a deadly attack. You had the right to use lethal force against him with your pistol. And the fact that you ran away afterwards because you were scared does not prove your guilt. A jury has to decide. There are a lot of reasons why a person would run away after a crime. They're afraid. They don't want the expense. They don't want the humiliation. They don't want to have to face it and go through the inconvenience of a trial. There are a dozen cases like this where the guy is convicted of murder, and the Supreme Court definitively says it's okay to borrow a rifle because you think you're in jeopardy. It's okay to go home and get your gun because you've been threatened time after time after time. David and I and Stephen dug all this up. It's all in there. It's the best defense of our civil right to keep and bear arms to come out in years. And I'm real happy it's there, and I thank you all for listening to me. Let me make one quick announcement. May I? This is how you steal an extra minute. I have one or two quick announcements. Some of you got the book. I have a sheet here that takes you through the hot spots, because it is 700 pages. And if you didn't get one, see me afterwards. The other thing is this. We're looking for some new laws to turn some of this around. I have a bunch of these little slips on one of the Second Amendment sisters' tables. This is for the Gun-Free Zone Act, Gun-Free Zone Liability Act. It just says, if you make a gun-free zone, you're liable for any harm it causes. Doesn't that make sense? It's been in Arizona twice. It's going in again this year. It was in Georgia last year. I have four other states interested in introducing it. I don't even care if it passes right away. I want the other side to have to fight with the fact that banning guns is dangerous, it's reckless, it's negligent, and it's fraudulent to suggest that if we put up a no-gun sign, you're safer. How dare they ban my firearm in this room because that'll make me safe. Thank you.
Dave Koppel.
Thank you. As we think about cases that might go to the Supreme Court, possibility, it appears to be growing that the Supreme Court may take a gun case soon. If I were a fervent gun control advocate, if I were a Supreme Court justice who were a fervent gun control advocate, I would certainly vote to grant certiorari and get a case to the Supreme Court as soon as possible. And I'd say, I know, and doing that as a gun prohibition or gun control advocate, I would know that I'd be taking a chance and that I might not win. And I'd say, you know, we've lost a lot of ground from, say, the early 1980s when we could sort of just contemptuously pretend the Second Amendment didn't exist and that it was all settled. And the thing that's changed since then has been, more than anything else, a explosion of legal scholarship on the Second Amendment, where there is now the other side is the one that's fighting back, the gun prohibition side, but there has been a tremendous amount of dozens, hundreds of law review articles now written on the Second Amendment, a gigantic change from the late 70s when you had only a few people like David Kaplan and Steve Holbrook out there just beginning to get the thing going and start a Second Amendment renaissance for scholarly attention. The Second Amendment, I would say if I were Justice Stevens, is getting too big to be ignored. There's too much coming up to the law reviews, and this is influencing the mind of the law clerks who influence judges. It will, over time, influence the composition of the judges. So if I were Justice Stevens, and I deeply, deeply, deeply believed in gun control, and you better believe he does, in our book, he has about one sentence which actually indicates that a right to arms may exist in an opinion. We cite that. But he has many paragraphs and pages in other cases where he goes on and on and on and on about how terrible gun violence is. He is the court's surest vote for anything upholding any form of gun control. And if I were him, I'd say, look, I'm an old man. I want to get the, and I'm the guy who's going to replace me on the Supreme Court if Bush gets reelected is going to be worse on the gun issue than me, and he might be the crucial vote. So let's get it on, and let's have it happen soon. And if I were handgun control, I'd say, you know, the Brady campaign they are these days, I'd say, you know, look, the cat got out of the bag, and we lost this ability to suppress the Second Amendment, pretend it didn't exist. Let's have the big battle now rather than later, because we've got a better chance of winning sooner than we do later. Let's go through the votes from the point of view of the anti-gun side. Realistically, they have to say Scalia, Rehnquist, and Thomas are lost to them on the existence of an individual right. Stevens is a almost certain vote for them. David Souter, he's claimed he's for the Second Amendment in private conversations with people, but when he was the Attorney General of New Hampshire, he filed a brief which, on arguing at some point upholding a New Hampshire gun law, said the Second Amendment was not an individual right. He is extremely concerned with his social standing among the Georgetown party set, among the genteel cocktail parties that the elite go to. He thinks more about them than probably anybody else on the Supreme Court. Rehnquist, Thomas, they don't care what other people think. If it makes other people mad, they just sit back, watch a football game, drink a beer, and laugh about it. David Souter's not that kind of guy. He does not like upsetting the people who he, his neighbors and the folks around him. Stephen Breyer, absolutely unconcerned and unconstrained by anything. His vote is for what the way society should be, precedent, prior anything, of essentially no significance to him. So you got a good start with them for three votes. They only need two more. Next one, those are their three easiest votes, the prohibition side, the no individual rights side. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, go both ways. In her confirmation hearing, Dianne Feinstein tried to get her to say there's no individual right. Ginsburg essentially dodged the question, says I shouldn't comment on it, and that was okay. She's smart. She's clearly, they're all smart. They're all clearly capable of understanding the arguments. But Ruth Bader Ginsburg is highly concerned with international law. She loves bringing in international treaties, not even treaties that have been ratified, just all that vast mass of international pseudo-law floating out there influences her a lot, and so does international opinion. Then take a look at Justice O'Connor, with whom Ruth Bader Ginsburg, in the book, wrote a concurring opinion in the Staples case involving whether you could prosecute somebody for having an unregistered machine gun because he had a malfunctioning semi-automatic which would double fire. And the court majority said, no, you can't. There has to be some more. You have to actually have some knowledge of what this defective gun is like. And you're not merely having a... Here's the point they made. Having a gun is not like having a bunch of C4 or some kind of thing which you should obviously know is highly regulated, and it's basically your risk to comply with all the laws. They said having a gun is a much more normal kind of thing, and we're not going to presume that everybody should be automatically held to the standard of knowing that their gun accidentally falls in this category of super high regulation. They said that in the context their exact words, but it's their point. In light of the high levels of gun ownership that have been allowed in this country. Okay, we're just to five votes. If that's what they think of gun ownership, that it has been allowed, that it's not a right, it's something the government may allow or may not, and they might not want to get rid of it all, but if it's something that's subject to allowance, well, there's your five votes right there, and then they've got one more to pick up, theoretically. Justice Kennedy has never said anything on the issue one way or the other. I'd say from the anti-gun point of view, he's the hardest one to pick up, partly because he wants to be Chief Justice, and so he's wobbled on the abortion issue, for example, joining the Planned Parenthood opinion with O'Connor, upholding Roe versus Wade when it was under its most serious threat. Since then, he's gone back on the pro-life side of the issue and voted reliably there and trying to keep the conservative coalition together. But you have potentially five votes there. And that doesn't mean they're for sure. And the Rehnquist O'Connor, they're really up in the air. Well, O'Connor grew up on a ranch shooting rifles, but she's moved left over her life on the court and has more concern with what the Georgetown set thinks of her than do Thomas or Rehnquist. And let me tell you, give you one final warning. Being right, being plainly right, isn't good enough in the Supreme Court. Let me give you two examples. Blaisdell versus Minnesota. Article 5 of the United States Constitution explicitly forbids any law impairing the obligation of contracts. There's not the slightest dispute that those laws were intended to prevent states from passing debtor relief laws, to say that your debt may be due by the contract on June 1, but we hereby give everybody in the state a one-year extension. It's as plainly unconstitutional as anything could possibly be. Minnesota passed one during the Great Depression. The Supreme Court upheld the Minnesota law 5-4, saying we have to balance the text of the Constitution, the original intent of the Constitution, with whatever they put on the other side to balance it with, and essentially nullify the most explicit constitutional language with the most undisputed original intent you could possibly have. And then just look at what happened this summer. You can argue about what the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause means, but the Civil Rights Act of 1964, in the most explicit language, prohibits state-based racial discrimination. There's no wiggle room around it. It's completely clear. And yet you had five justices upheld, under certain circumstances, state-based racial discrimination in college and graduate school admissions, and Justice O'Connor and Justice Ginsburg were two of them. They're not stupid people. They can read a statute, and if it says one thing, very plainly, they know what it means. So if the Supreme Court grants certiorari in the Silvera case, which Chuck is going to talk about, obviously everybody on the pro-rights side is going to do everything we can for writing amicus briefs and trying to help win the case, but don't come close to even thinking that we are guaranteed to win the case. And if we do, hypothetically, the highest side of a win is a decision saying, yes, there's an individual right, and B, it is subject to a reasonableness test, which will uphold all state gun laws, almost all laws, that are short of prohibitions. And that's the way state constitutional right to arms are generally interpreted these days by state courts with state constitutions that give an unmistakable individual right. That's the high side. And there is a real low side that the court may nullify the Second Amendment. And I am very worried if Silvera goes to the Supreme Court. Thank you.
Since Dave touched on it in just a moment, I just want to say something before Chuck stands up. The U.S. Supreme Court on Friday ordered the California Department of Justice to file a response to the Silvera cert petition. And this sort of has come out of left field to all of us since the panel was put together. And this is a really big deal. This is the big deal, sort of.
Let me talk about that in just a second. But first, let me give you a little background on what we got going on in the United States Supreme Court. And consider it in this context. Dave's done a very good job of laying out kind of how the votes might fall in the United States Supreme Court. And Second Amendment scholars can debate about that for hours, trying to figure out and predict what the inclinations are of each of those justices. Bottom line is, we don't know for sure, and we can't predict with a whole lot of certainty. But that alone is enough to make a strong argument, if not a compelling argument, that now is not a good time to take a Second Amendment case to the United States Supreme Court. That said, you certainly don't want to take a case that has baggage that you don't need to be dragging along with you on the trip. Right now, there are actually four cases kind of winding their way to the United States Supreme Court. Silvera, the recent case out of the Ninth Circus, Circuit Court of Appeals, just happens to be the furthest along. There are two cases in D.C. And one other case in the Ninth Circuit, which the NRA and I and Steve Holbrook have all been working on, along with Don Kilmer, who's the lead lawyer in that case. That's a case challenging an ordinance that bans gun shows. And we didn't bring that case with the Second Amendment in mind. Curiously enough, the Ninth Circuit actually raised that issue almost on its own and asked for supplemental briefing. But that case we have not gotten an en banc ruling on that yet. And in fact, that case is stayed pending to see what the United States Supreme Court does with Silvera. Consider, when the Ninth Circuit three-judge panel makes a ruling, you can petition for en banc review. If you've been following recall, you just saw this happen. And from that en banc review, you can ask the United States Supreme Court to take your case or not, but, and they will or not, and usually they don't. In the case of Silveria, that case was filed in 1999 in response to California's Assault Weapon Control Act, I should say some amendments to it, that banned guns based on their features rather than on the make and model, which is what California's 89 law did. You guys all heard about how bad it is in California right now, and I certainly sympathize with people who want to try and do something about it, but on the other hand, going about filing lawsuits because you don't think the NRA is doing its job or something along those lines is not a good reason, particularly when, in response to that law, the NRA filed its own lawsuit, Hunt versus Lockyer, which raised a number of different issues. It was filed by a district attorney for Kern County, in other words, one of the chief law enforcement officer in the county of Kern, and the chief DA in Mendocino, suing the attorney general. It's an unprecedented lawsuit, and it pits credibility of a district attorney against the attorney general, rather than in California, it's not wise to have the NRA as your plaintiff, because you're likely to get a very unsympathetic judge. Liberal judges hate the Second Amendment. Conservative judges may uphold the Second Amendment, but they hate overturning laws. And the Second Amendment, and having it held to be a fundamental right, what we're trying to do is restrict the government from being able to pass laws, not lose sight of that. Otherwise, it's a Second Amendment with no teeth. Now, in the case of Silveria, the Ninth Circuit had already rejected the Second Amendment theory, individual rights theory, no less than five times. When that case was brought, that decision was as predictable as it was avoidable. The only reason we got a front page news decision out of the Ninth Circuit on the Second Amendment was because Justice Reinhart, most liberal judge in the country, took the Silveria case as an opportunity to deconstruct the Emerson decision. A court of appeals, a decision that did not exist when Silveria was first filed. It's almost certain that if it hadn't been for the Emerson decision, Silveria ruling in the Ninth Circuit would not have made the news and would have been a one-line dismissal of the theory, just like the three preceding cases were. So now the Silveria case is pending in front of the United States Supreme Court. They've asked the court to hear that case. Typically what happens is the government agency that is opposing a Supreme Court case or a petition for writ of certiorari may or may not file an opposition right out of the blocks. If they don't, and if the Supreme Court wants to hear more, then they will order the government agency to file a response. That's what just happens in Silveria. It doesn't necessarily mean they're going to take the case, but it does mean that there's enough judges interested that they've ordered the DOJ to file a brief saying why they shouldn't take it. Compare the Silveria case to the Cato Institute case. In the Cato Institute case, you have a handgun ban. It's a very broad law. And the guns are not per se bad, evil guns like a quote-unquote assault weapon and all the misperceptions that exist about assault weapons. We've got a law that is vulnerable. Then you're in the D.C. Circuit. The Bill of Rights does not automatically apply to states. It only applies to the federal government, so it has to be incorporated to the states in order for any individual right to apply. The Second Amendment has not been incorporated yet. It's a second fundamental battle that needs to take place before we're going to get any protection from the Second Amendment at the state level, at least. The challenge to the D.C. gun ban does not involve incorporation because you're in federal jurisdiction. There's no state action. And then, obviously, you need a court to uphold the Second Amendment aspect. Now, it'd be nice if we could find a case that would do just one. The Silveria case, and that's what the Cato Institute case does, basically. It just challenges a broad law which is vulnerable on Second Amendment ground. By contrast, the Silveria case, you're going to need to get the votes to get the Second Amendment as a fundamental right incorporated against the states because it's challenging a state assault weapon control act, and then you're going to need the justices to apply a standard of review that law which invalidates that law. First law out of the blocks that we're going to be challenging if the Silveria case makes it to the Supreme Court is one of the most complicated, misunderstood, and distorted, factually and technically distorted areas of the law that there is, assault weapons. The abuses that the district court judge has done in the Cato Institute case are typical. I've been litigating cases in the California state and federal courts for 10 years. I have seen judges do intellectual, I shouldn't say intellectual, mental backflips in order to rule the way they want to rule. And those just kind of typify the lengths that they will go to screw gun owners if they're inclined to. So what we're liable to get, at best, is a Second Amendment decision that says the Second Amendment is a fundamental right. It may or may not be incorporated to the states. And if it is, even if it is or a fundamental right, the standard of review is liable to be set very low because they will not want to invalidate, first case out of the blocks, an assault weapon law. Don't need to look any further than five state Supreme Court decisions with equivalent state constitutional equivalents to the right to keep and bear arms, where those state Supreme Courts ruled that the assault weapon laws in those states, despite the fact that there was a fundamental right, those assault weapon laws were not unreasonable, so they were not unconstitutional. And the recent Ohio decision, they'll be talking about CCW cases a little bit later, the recent Ohio decision there, in fact, Ohio has an RKBA provision in its state constitution, and that did not stop them from upholding the constitutionality of a ban on carrying concealed weapons, because they characterize it as a manner restriction. In other words, it doesn't take away your right to own all guns. It says you can't carry them concealed. People are operating under a fundamental misconception that the Second Amendment in the United States Supreme Court will be some kind of a magic bullet, which will result in strict scrutiny review. That's the highest level of review, typically reserved for political speech. There are a whole bunch of different levels of review. The anti-gun forces are already putting their briefs together on why the reasonableness test is the most important test, is the most appropriate test. That's what they're going to be arguing, and that's the fight we're going to be having. David did an excellent article on the Silveria case. It's posted at through my website, links to National Review Online, calgunlaws.com. I just point out there is widespread agreement, not just me talking here. All the Second Amendment scholars in this country essentially agree that Silveria is a poor choice to put our freedoms in front of the Supreme Court right now and our children's freedoms in front of the court right now. It's the equivalent of standing with your hand in front of your face and saying, "See if you can hit my hand before I move it." It would be funny if the stakes weren't so high. I'm sorry that Mr. Gorski isn't here, the lawyer who brought that case on behalf of his rugby buddies, and I certainly would not support that case if we prevail or make the best of a bad situation with Silveria, which is what the NRA and Second Amendment Foundation and all the other groups will have to do. It's going to take some good lawyering and some good amicus briefs. You're going to support anything if that case gets accepted. Support those competent attorneys at those agencies or those associations who are going to hopefully save us from the Silveria case. Thank you.
I realized when I put you three over there, I'd be asking three of you to share a mic. So if one of you want to move over here, so there's just two of you on a mic.
Oh, no.
No, no, no. You can have it by yourself, Alan.
We can pass.
Alan's a mic dog.
No, I'm serious.
We knew you were tough, Julianne, but this is ridiculous.
I turned myself up. Okay. I had some questions that I was going to ask our four experts here, and one of them sort of just get pulled out from underneath me. But Chuck touched on it. Why is the Supreme Court reluctant, and are they still reluctant, to take a Second Amendment case head on?
Remember, the Supreme Court has a finite amount of political capital that it wants to spend on doing controversial things. And there are a lot of justices, for example, who think that abortion is such an important right, which the court having created that a while ago, they want to preserve that right, and they'll spend a lot of political capital on that. They also have institutional limitations for how many things they can do and how many cases they want to take. And they recognize that if you can't just do one gun case. If you do one, then you're going to have to get into the whole business, you know, like they do with the First Amendment. They get lots of First Amendment cases every year, and every year they have a half dozen to a dozen cases that are mainly First Amendment ones. So as I think they've ignored it partly because they say, we don't want to get into that. You know, we've got enough other things to do, and we're not really sure what the law should be. And just let the political process sort it out. I think part of what's happened is that it's become harder to ignore the issue intellectually than it was when they were first on the court in the early 80s.
Chuck?
I would say they're not reluctant to take a case. They have taken 92 cases on this subject. They have definitively said we have an individual right. The only thing they can do now is reverse their standing. You have rights. They've said it dozens and dozens and dozens of times. They could take a case now which would undo it. So I would ask, what's the validity of a case? And the reason they haven't taken one recently is because both us, the pro side, and the anti-right side are afraid to go to the court for the reasons he just said.
There have been a couple of cases that raised the Second Amendment that asked the Supreme Court to hear them in, you know, the last 5 years or so. Whether or not those cases, for other reasons, were not accepted for review. There is a theory in Washington, and I don't work in Washington, so I don't hear this, but this is the fairly well-regarded impression that many people there have, that it's actually our friends on the Supreme Court who are voting not to take the cases. Remember, it takes 4 votes to take the case. And if we have 3, but they know we don't have a 4th, then those 3 might vote against taking the case, because they know we don't have the 5th that you need to win the case in the end. So that's something that I think lawyers in Washington, D.C. are very plugged into, and may be an explanation for some of that.
The criterion that the court applies in deciding whether to take a case is whether or not there's been a circuit split. The Second Circuit and the D.C. Circuit haven't decided their view of the Second Amendment. All of the other circuits have decided that the Second Amendment conferred secures some variation of collective right, with the exception of the Fifth Circuit in the Emerson case. Of course, that decision only came very recently. So it wasn't until Emerson that arguably we have a split in the circuits. I say arguably because there are a lot of folks who believe that Emerson did not hold, as a matter of holding, that there was an individual right to keep and bear arms, but rather that the opinion in Emerson is what the lawyers call dicta, that is, a side statement by the judge in the case, by the panel of judges, that really wasn't necessary to the holding in the case. Frankly, I share that view. I think Emerson is dicta. I suspect there's a split among the panelists here as to whether that's the case. So you may have a split in the circuits now as a result of the Fifth Circuit. And of course, that's a very recent one. So it does suggest that the Supreme Court may now look more favorably on a cert petition. I think it's important to note this as far as whether or not we ought to look favorably upon the prospect of a cert petition being granted. Obviously, we want the very best case to go up to the Supreme Court on the facts as well as on the law. And the Silvera case, as a couple of our panelists have said, is not that case. The Silvera case, the assault weapons ban, by the way, is semi-automatic pistols, more than 10 rounds, semi-automatic rifles with detachable magazines, guns usable with silencers and grenade launchers. Now, this is, you know, it's just not the best fact pattern when you compare that to an outright ban on all pistols in the home in Washington, D.C. But that said, imagine this, except in the Second Circuit and in the D.C. Circuit, in every other circuit across the nation, Fifth Circuit, of course, except, you don't have a federal individual right to keep and bear arms. The circuit courts in those states, in all of those states, have decided that the Second Amendment is a collective right. So what happens if we don't have cert? Well, basically, it's not that you don't have any rights at all, but you don't have any rights under the Second Amendment in those circuits. What do you have? You have whatever rights are secured for you under the state constitutions and under state statutes. Well, suppose there's cert granted and then we lose. Same situation. You will still have whatever rights are granted to you under state constitutions and state statutes. So I think there's at least a plausible argument that there's a limited downside in terms of cert. I'm not suggesting, of course, that we ought to be complacent about a loss in the Supreme Court. It would be devastating. But frankly, what good is a right that can't be vindicated? And right now, we do not have a vindicated right under the Second Amendment at the federal level.
David?
A couple quick follow-ups. A loss on the Second Amendment individual rights issue in the Supreme Court also greenlights state Supreme Courts, many of which have language that's quite similar to the Second Amendment, to follow the Supreme Court and declare their state right not to be an individual right. It would be intellectually indefensible, but it would certainly happen in some states. Circuit splits are some of the things that come to the court, but a circuit split doesn't at all guarantee that the Supreme Court will hear a case. There are circuit splits that have existed, 6-5 splits on interpretation of federal statutory issues, for example, that have been out there for decades, and the court has just said, it's not going to resolve it. It'll be one way in one part of the country, another way in another part of the country. So a circuit split does not mean automatic Supreme Court review. The thing that comes pretty close to automatically getting the court's attention for review is when a federal statute is declared unconstitutional. Their ears really perk up on that one. And you can see in the Emerson case how the judges, on the one hand, in the majority, write a pretty pro-rights opinion with a high standard of review for Second Amendment cases. It would be wonderful if the Emerson standard of review became the national standard. And despite that high standard of review, they go through some amazing contortions, and not really very plausible ones, in order to somehow make sure that Emerson loses this case as applied to him, and that they do not declare that federal statute unconstitutional in this case. And it's pretty clear the reason they were doing that is they wanted to make sure their decision didn't go to the Supreme Court. So you have two Fifth Circuit judges who are very pro-Second Amendment. They wanted to keep the case away from the Supreme Court and worked extremely hard to do so. I think that ought to tell you something about the risks of a case going to the Supreme Court.
Now we've scared everybody in the room. What I'd like to ask is why do we, the scholars here, why is all the, and the attorneys, why is all the research, all the writing and everything on our side? Why do we have the history, the reason, the law, and the other side has the rhetoric and the emotion, and why are they winning? At least apparently. At least why do they have us scared?
First of all, being right doesn't get you everything, and secondly, it's not 100 to 0 on the legal on the precedent and the legal history and everything else. It's clearly in favor of the individual right on the balance. And if you got some judge came down from Mars and couldn't care one way or the other about guns and just wanted to be intellectually honest and you were thorough, we'd win the case in front of that judge. But it's not. There's not nothing going for the other side in their arguments, and we are winning over time. The law review revolution that Steve Holbrook and David Kaplan started is going very well, and it is changing the legal intellectual climate and law. But things move slowly, and federal judges, people with lifetime appointments, they're sort of the lagging indicator. The first thing that changes intellectually in laws will be scholarships and student activists and things like not grants to students, but legal research and the students. And then over time, those people get jobs and the intellectual climate changes. The last ones who catch up to that are the federal judges, because they're on a much slower cycle. And their intellectual world was shaped several decades ago, such as in the 1960s or 1970s, when they may have been in law school, and the Second Amendment was beneath contempt views of constitutional professors at the time.
Let me take a broader perspective on that. Do any of you belong to the ACLU? Only one. You ought to join the ACLU and see what they think. They sit in a meeting like this, and they're as scared as you are now because they think we're winning. I'm serious. Both sides think the other side is winning. We make a major mistake here. We argue logic and reason and history and law, which is on our side. There's no question about that. And it doesn't affect them. So we're arguing wrong. That's the problem. Not that we're losing. We're just not arguing right. How do you argue right? You don't need to study law anymore. I'll talk against my own book. You don't need to know more cases. You need to read How to Win Friends and Influence People. You need to read Getting to Yes, Getting Past No. You have to read Confrontational Politics by Richardson. You got to read books that talk about how to get the other guy to think like you do. That's more important than the law and the reason, because we do have that. And for whatever it's worth, they're scared. I can't use the word. They're scared. And they ought to be scared, because we're strong. And just remember that they think the same thing you do. And we're armed.
Okay. And the last question before, okay. Go ahead.
Just a very quick comment, and that is about this disparity in intellectual resources between our side and the other side. Bear in mind that the Second Amendment case that the Supreme Court did resolve, although it didn't resolve the issue of individual versus collective rights, that was during the New Deal in 1939, the late part of Roosevelt's term. We haven't had anything up with the Supreme Court that squarely addressed this individual versus collective issue in 65 years. And it wasn't until 1989 that the scholarship started tilting heavily in our direction with Sanford Levinson's article in the Yale Law.
The embarrassing
Second Amendment. So you're not talking about a whole lot of time. You're talking about 14 years. Over that 14-year period, there's been an outpouring of research, for some of whom from people sitting at this panel, and others as well. And I do think it's fair to say that the research has much favored, not just in terms of quantity, but more particularly in quality, the argument that the Second Amendment confers an individual right. But in the scheme of things, 14 years is not a whole lot of time. So while we have the argument on our side, while the trend is in our direction, sometimes these things take a while to unfold.
I'd like to close it on what would an anti-rights decision mean? Is it relevant or is it valid?
Well, if we get an anti-Second Amendment decision out of the United States Supreme Court, that will be the final word on that constitutional issue for 100 years, as far as the court's concerned. But we'll be right back in the legislature arguing about the fundamental. To me, actually, if you really think about it in terms of natural law and what our human rights are, Second Amendment is superfluous. We have a right to self-defense. No government can give it to you or take it away from you. And a constitution or not, and then it will become a policy debate, and the NRA will, and by the way, whichever way it goes, it's the Full Employment Act for lawyers. There will be, if we get a Second Amendment decision that upholds the Second Amendment, there will be 10 years of litigation over where exactly you draw the line, what's reasonable, what level of scrutiny should be applied to what different law. That will go on for a long time. And if you don't, they'll all be just wearing the tasseled loafers on K Street instead.
He touches on it. The worse it gets, the better it gets. If they decide that you don't have rights, like this guy said, we're all armed. If they decided that slavery is okay, does that mean slavery's okay? Is that what that means? If they say you can't have your guns, that's the very reason we have a Second Amendment, to prevent tyranny in government, to protect our God-given rights, to have our human rights intact, regardless of what a tyrannical government says, regardless of law, reason, and history, which they would have to do to make that decision.
Yeah, you know, if you look at the chat rooms and things like that, where people are saying Silvera is the wonderful case, and if we lose, the worse the better, because that'll just bring on the Second Amendment revolution. They're living in a fantasy world, because this country is not by any remote stretch ready for revolution, and it'll, you know, they're just living in a extremely dangerous fantasy world. Of course, I agree. Your right to bear arms, as the Cruikshank case says, isn't granted by the Constitution. It's a fundamental human right that's recognized by it. And so, yes, if they, regardless of what the court says, you continue, in my view, to have a fundamental moral natural law right to have a gun, but it's not going to be a right that's recognized in any court in the United States, so it doesn't do you much good other than in your own personal satisfaction. I'd rather have a right that has meaningful enforcement. And there's one other, besides the fact that it'll, a bad Second Amendment decision will take down a lot of state constitutions with it, as a matter of practice. There's also the fact that the biggest protection that exists is the NRA and the pro-gun groups tend to be winning in state legislatures and Congress most of the time. One of the reasons they win is because state legislators believe that there's an individual right, and they treat that seriously and conscientiously. Over time, a contrary Supreme Court decision may not change the mind of some guy who's been a state senator for 40 years, has always been a good pro-gun guy, but it means the guy who eventually has his seat, he'll have grown up with the understanding that there is no individual right and that gun control is purely a matter of public policy, one way or the other. The right to bear arms isn't going to be in his heart, and over time,
that will be catastrophic for the kind of gun laws that get enacted.
Bob, I'll let you end this, all right?
All right.
Thank you.
The Supreme Court can indeed get it wrong, and still that's very harmful. There's an old saying that says that the Supreme Court is not final because it's infallible. Rather, the Supreme Court is infallible because it's final. Now, what that means effectively is that because the Supreme Court is the last word on the subject, we have to treat the Supreme Court as if it's infallible, even though we know for sure that it's not infallible. Now, that said, it's still the case, as Dave's pointed out, that we have state constitutions, we have state statutes. It's also the case that the Second Amendment is not the last word on the right to keep and bear arms. The problem with the Second Amendment that we've all been struggling with is the prefatory clause, the militia clause, and that's what's caused all of the disagreement amongst the courts. That doesn't apply when you get to the Ninth Amendment. The Ninth Amendment says that we have rights that are unenumerated that we retain from a state of nature before the Constitution ever existed. We retain those rights. It has nothing to do with militias. Self-defense is quite clearly one of those rights. So there would be an outpouring of litigation trying to breathe some life into the Ninth Amendment. That could be extended into a right to self-defense. There will be a lot going on at the state level. But it is true, if we lose in the Supreme Court, with respect to the federal rights under the Second Amendment, nothing short of revolution or a constitutional amendment is going to help us.
Okay, I'd like to thank our panelists. And Bob Levy, would you come here for a minute? You haven't been on one of my panels before, so you haven't been subject to the timer. So Mr. Waldron just wants to give you something to make up for it.
Thank you. Mentioned earlier at lunch during the awards luncheon that we give out a series of awards, and one of the monthly awards that the committee gives out is the Gun Rights Defender of the Month. And without any further ceremony, I would like to present the Defender of the Month Award, Gun Rights Defender of the Month Award, for the month of September 2003.